There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media and a critical look at our media environment. My name is Paul Reisman. I'm your host. Producer Drew Tirico is at the controls. On today's program, we're celebrating 5 years of indie media. Yes, it was in November 30th, 1999, when the World Trade Organization found itself meeting massive street protests in the streets of Seattle. And the first independent media center went on the web to provide coverage that the corporate media wouldn't. We'll reflect back on that, as well as we'll reflect back on the WTO and the protests then. And we also got a little bit of good news in our headlines. Do stay tuned. Each week here at Media Geek, we bring you some headline news. These are stories that don't make it into the electronic media and often are stashed in the back of the business pages in the print media, because stories about media are treated like business or entertainment stories, not stories about politics and democracy. And we'd like to start off with a little bit of good news. After spending nearly 2 months in jail, Champaign resident Patrick Thompson is home, and felony eavesdropping charges against him have been dropped by newly elected state's attorney Julia Reitz.
Julia Reitz.
That's bad proofreading there. Just hours after she was sworn into office. Thompson was one of two men charged with felony eavesdropping earlier this year by former Champaign County state's attorney John Pyland. Pyland filed the charges against the men for having videotaped Champaign police officers conducting traffic stops and other duties in public as part of a documentary on police treatment of African Americans in Champaign-Urbana. Pyland dropped the charges against the other man, Martel Miller, after significant community outcry and when both the Champaign chief of police and city manager requested the charges be dropped. However, Pyland refused to drop charges against Thompson, who faces other unrelated felony charges. Thompson still faces those charges, but was released today on his own recognizance when Reitz asked to have his $250,000 bail dropped.
The Champaign City Council considered a proposal to expand the scope of the city's government cable channel to include educational programming at a study session held on November 30th. The proposal came from city staff, and the council decided that the issue should be examined more before programming is added. In particular, the council asked city staff to return with more specific criteria and guidelines for the type of programming that would be aired on the city's channel. Currently, the channel airs city meetings and runs a bulletin board in between programs. The council did not seem interested in expanding the scope of the city's channel to include public access programming, like Urbana's UPTV, which is a hybrid government and public access channel. The council is expected to take up the issue again in March or April when the city staff returns with the requested criteria.
Democratic FCC Commissioners Michael Copps and Jonathan Adelstein will be holding a forum on media concentration in St. Paul, Minnesota on December 9th. The forum will be organized into two panels, local news and information and media diversity. After the panels, there will be an opportunity for members of the general public to make comments. According to a commission press release, the purpose of the hearing is to give citizens outside of Washington, D.C. an opportunity to voice their opinions about media consolidation and to offer comments on how the agency can develop protections that provide citizens with viewpoints from a diversity of sources and enhance the marketplace of ideas.
FCC Chairman Michael Powell told a telecommunications policy conference on December 2nd that he believes it will take 7 years in order to establish new media ownership regulations. The commission's last attempt at revising these rules, which raised considerable ire from the public and public interest groups, were struck down by the Third Circuit Court of Appeals last June. FCC lawyers are currently considering appealing that ruling to the Supreme Court. Powell told the conference that he believes that currently the media environment is now chaotic. The 7 years will be necessary not just to resolve the case of the recent rules revision, but to reestablish, quote, both a framework and a national consensus, end quote, about what the nature of media ownership regulation should be.
On November 29th, Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell signed into law new legislation that will severely limit the ability of cities and municipalities in that state to construct their own free wireless networks and other telecommunications services. Although Rendell acknowledged that these limits are a, quote, problem, end quote, he pointed to Verizon's agreement to waive its right to stop Philadelphia's plan for a Wi-Fi network and said the state would, quote, work with other municipalities on projects that they have established or proposed to establish in order to ensure that, to the extent that they are now viable, they will also have the opportunity to succeed, end quote. Under the terms of the new law, Pennsylvania municipalities are not utterly prohibited from providing telecommunications services. However, they are required to give the right of first refusal to commercial telecommunications providers like Verizon. These providers are under no obligation to provide services at the same level or cost as those that would be provided by a municipality. In an analysis of this new law on his weblog, Sasha Meinrath, who is coordinator of the Champaign-Urbana Community Wireless Network, puts it this way, quote, Verizon stands to gain huge public subsidies for their network, forcing municipalities to purchase equipment and services from them, while at the same time preventing these same municipalities from competing and passing any cost savings onto the public who's paying for these subsidies. End quote.
And in a related issue, which is a bit of better news, actually, the Telecommunications Industry Association, or TIA, has issued a formal consent to the FCC to turn unused portions of television's frequency spectrum over to unlicensed broadband usage. This comes amid a growing firestorm of debate about community-owned internet service providers and their effect on other ISPs' business. Urging the FCC to quickly adopt the rules that would allow the use of unlicensed wireless transmitters in the TV band, the TIA argued that TV frequencies will allow service at, quote, greater distances than higher frequency bands currently used by unlicensed devices, end quote. Politically, TIA added to its comments its support of safeguards to ensure that devices operating in TV frequency bands do not interfere with TV broadcasts, TV receivers, or other uses already authorized for use on the TV broadcast spectrum. This portion of the spectrum could be used for community wireless access projects, such as the prototype being developed here in Champaign-Urbana. At a community wireless network conference sponsored by the CU Wind project that took place last September of this year, a main subject for discussion was the issue of spectrum licensing. Speakers such as Harold Feld and Rob Flickinger emphasized the need for an open policy on spectrum usage in order to ensure that wireless networks stay inexpensive enough for grassroots organizations' use.
And as a footnote to that, I know that the television networks like NBC are fighting that with the FCC. And the bandwidth we're talking about is a lot of very unused UHF bandwidth. Because there aren't that many UHF channels out there, though there's lots allocated. And, of course, the bandwidth, which will be ceded eventually, someday, by the television stations as they switch over to new digital frequencies, which is something they're dragging their feet on and really reticent to do because right now they have double the bandwidth that they used to have because they have their old analog bandwidth, which is mostly still be using. They're still using, and then they have the digital bandwidth, which some of them are broadcasting on and some of them plan to broadcast on, and they sure as heck don't want to give up that valuable commodity. So this will be an interesting fight as it continues on. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a little bit of what's going on in our media environment. You're listening to Media Geek. And when we're not on the air, check us out online, www.mediageek.org. Coming up in just a moment, the 5th anniversary of Indie Media. Do stay tuned. November 30th of 1999 goes down in history books as the Battle of Seattle, when thousands upon thousands of street protesters met the World Trade Organization ministerial meetings that were happening in Seattle, Washington. And it was a protest that was unexpected by the WTO. It was unexpected by the Seattle Police Department, who in many ways greatly overreacted to the mostly peaceful protest.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also the birth of the IND Media Center, IMC, which since that time has grown to a network of over 100 different independent media centers localized around the world, as well as regional independent media centers like the recently birthed Independent Media Center US, www.indymedia.us, which attempts to give a place to bring together all the stories that are going on in the United States, and also as an attempt to not have the stories of the United States dominate or predominate over stories of the globe, since so much of the time American news and American culture and American stories are predominant. This is an effort to not have it be utterly predominant in the global sphere on the indymedia.org, the main site. If we go back to Wednesday, November 24th, 1999, at 6:45 p.m., that is when the first post was made to the first independent media center website, www.indymedia.org. And here's that post. The resistance is global. A trans-Pacific collaboration has brought this website into existence. The web dramatically alters the balance between multinational and activist media. With just a bit of coding and some cheap equipment, we can set up a live automated website that rivals the corporates. Prepare to be swamped by the tide of activist media makers on the ground in Seattle and around the world, telling the real story behind the World Trade Agreement. And indeed, this was a very special website compared to anything that had come before it, since it gave people the ability to both post text, audio, video, and pictures freely to a global audience on the web. And it was given to anyone who wanted to go ahead and upload. And up to this point, there really was never quite a website that brought together quite this way, nor was it connected to something like the WTO process. And back in 1999, I did a show on WFT here called Radio Free Conscience, which is very similar to Media Geek, although it aired Sunday mornings. It was every other week, sort of the proto version in a way. And I talked to several activists from Champaign-Urbana who had been out in Seattle in 1999 and been to the Independent Media Center. So we got a little bit of audio from the interview, which aired on December 13th of 1999. And this is Peter Miller, who was a WEFT air shifter for many years. He is the creator of the Illinois Labor Hour, which airs on Saturdays here on WEFT, and also one of the co-founders of the Independent Media Center in Urbana-Champaign. So here in this excerpt, he's going to tell us about the Independent Media Center, the very first one there in Seattle.
I was really impressed with this outfit. It was an independent media center for activists, and this is something that just the activists in Seattle had set up, and they found a storefront. They found a few storefronts, actually, that they were able to rent, and then they were able to set up an entire network, a local area network that was also connected to the web. And this was designed to be a place where independent media activists from around the country could just come in and have resources that they could use for both getting information, for both recording information, recording what was happening out on the streets, but also editing it and producing it and putting it out on the web. And it was really an unbelievable thing to see this, that this existed. And it wasn't sponsored by anyone. It wasn't sponsored by anyone notable like Public Citizen or the Sierra Club or the International Forum on Globalization. This was just grassroots activists. They ended up going something like $70,000 in debt to get the thing to happen, or maybe even more than that, to get the space and to get the computers and the editing equipment. And when we got there, it was all set to go. I mean, you showed up and you checked in, you got a press pass, and they showed you, they wanted you to volunteer. It was all volunteer run, so when you got your press pass, you agreed to do a volunteer shift in the center, either checking people in, doing the phones, doing security. There were all kinds of different things that just needed to happen in order for the center to stay open, and they relied on people who showed up to do that. And then once you got there, you had access to anything you needed. So when I got there, I could have gone, if I didn't have my own field recorder, I could have gone and checked out one of, I think, five or ten mini disc recorders, little portable mini disc recorders that I could have just taken out onto the street and used to pick up audio and follow people around and get media to put back out on the web to give the world my perspective on what was happening in Seattle. And also there were editing facilities and all kinds of things. So it was really, really just amazing to me to see this whole thing set up just by some grassroots activists who decided that it was what they wanted to do. And at the end, I mean, I was working the check-in table and for a while, on Monday, actually, and we had given out probably 200 or 300 press passes by that point. And these are just independent people coming into town who wanted to, you know, help them get the message out about what was happening in Seattle. So people from community radio stations, from independent zines, from cable TV, from public access television networks, just anyone who wanted to, could show up and take care of this. On the first day, on Monday or Sunday night, actually, they had someone, one of their group, kind of self-nominated himself to lead this thing, and he got up and gathered everyone around and said, all right, we're going to go through the list of events, and we need people to volunteer to take them all right? We want one video, one audio, and one print person on each of these events if we can do it. And he just went down this list of... it was just an incredible list of events, and people volunteered to take them, and they volunteered to go out and cover those events and bring the stuff back to the center. So I was really impressed with everything that they did, really. I mean, it was kind of chaotic, and some things didn't always work, but to have that kind of a facility available to people and to have that open and to kind of bypass the corporate media and to bypass the for-profit media, which is all of the media in the country, right? Mm-hmm. I thought that was just really important.
And that was Peter Miller. He's a former WEFT airshifter, and he was out at the WTO protest in Seattle in 1999. He participated in the very first Independent Media Center, and he told us about it on a previous incarnation of the Media Geek program back in December of 1999. And I have to say that when I remember that weekend pretty well, I'm sure as many people do. I was glued in many ways to the TV and to the radio, and glued to the Independent Media Center website, indiemedia.org, and constantly reading and downloading and just amazed, absolutely amazed at all of the interesting news and information that was coming there and how much it varied and how different it was from what I was seeing on mainstream television, what I was seeing on NBC or CNN. It was eye-opening for me, and I was already, you know, sort of immersed in independent media at that point, you know, and fairly aware of, you know, public access television, community radio, the underground press. And even for me, it was just an amazing moment to sit there and be able to see it happen right there on the web.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know, Drew.
My experience is quite the opposite, actually. Unfortunately, I at that time I was a senior in high school, and I was November. No, I just graduated high school. I was a freshman here at the university, actually, and I had not really been exposed to the independent media movement at all, because I come from the suburbs of Chicago where independent media just simply does not really exist. Community media outlets do not exist except for maybe, you know, like a town herald thing that's put together by businesses in the town. So, but afterward, you know, this whole wave of independent media, the buzz went out on the internet, and I started picking up on this, and that's how I started getting involved. I started learning, you know, and I learned that there's an independent media center here in town later, you know.
Yeah, it was really quite a spark. And then what's interesting, I think, about it is, one, from the very beginning, it put into principles of non-hierarchical organization and real consensual organization. And although maybe in that last example Peter brought, you know, someone stood up and tried to hand out assignments, it wasn't as an editor or as a boss, but it was a matter of, okay, here's some things going on, just to sort of lend some order to things and let people step forward. So he wasn't assigning it to people. People were stepping up and saying, that's what I'm interested in doing. It just needed someone to stand up and sort of and let people know what was going on, to bring that information to everyone assembled there at the Independent Media Center. And that has become an extremely important, intrinsic principle of the Independent Media Center movement. And in my opinion, one of the things that's actually allowed it to survive as it has and propagate like it has in these 5 years, because there is no head.
Right.
You know, in fact, the Seattle Independent Media Center is right now on hiatus. It actually has closed, and it closed by consensus of the people involved, and there was a bit of a rift, and they decided that given the way things were going, it was best to close down. But that hasn't ended IMC, in sure. fact, and IMCs have opened and closed over the course of the last 5 years, but nevertheless, they continue to spread because each Independent Media Center is an autonomous unit
right.
that chooses to cooperate and chooses to network itself with other IMCs. And there is a network set of principles of unity, which every group that wants to join the network has to agree to by consensus, say that we agree to these principles. And some of these things are operating non-hierarchically. But that is all it really takes. Mm-hmm. And because, I mean, there's not assets of the network in the same way. Like right. here in Urbana-Champaign, the Urbana-Champaign IMC owns its own server, owns most of its own, its own facilities or rents them. It's all locally funded, and so it's not requiring any funding from the big head, from the big independent media center, and right. can continue to operate autonomously, but gets the benefits of operating and having all these other independent media centers around the world, and it also allows there to be mutual aid, especially in helping out independent media centers in the global south and in areas far less well-connected in the global communication superhighway or well-connected economically speaking.
Yeah, that is a staple of the IMC movement in general, because it is definitely the first big open access media movement to really ever come out, especially in the electronic press. But it does work, use its size to push centers that occur in sort of quote-unquote third world countries or countries that don't have these kind of advantages that we do here.
Yeah, rather than becoming a conglomerate.
Exactly. But it still leaves, there's still plenty of room for other open access media projects, and the IMC acknowledges them and wants to work with them as well. The IMC is certainly not an exclusive network, and the IMC appreciates all forms of independent media, like the fact that the Seattle IMC closed. Obviously, independent media hasn't disappeared from Seattle. Independent media is still
alive. No, in fact, what's interesting is that there's a group called Reclaim the Media that's mm-hmm. operates out of Seattle that came out of in 2002 when they held a conference there by the same name, Reclaim the Media, that was hosted at the IMC and in cooperation with the IMC and grew out of the IMC, although it's more of a media reform organization, so it had different goals. And that continues to go on, and it continues to help to seed things and does a lot to help support public access television and other things in the Seattle area. And it continues to move on, you know, even though the IMC in particular may not still be operating like it once was. And it was never in competition. It was always in cooperation.
Exactly.
And that is, I think, another great hallmark of it, is that the IMC movement is not attempting to take over other things. It's not operating in competition. It's not trying to, you know, bring in things and take them over so much as be sort of it's a mutual aid kind of situation. And I think it's important to kind of bring in a little bit of the history of the Independent Media Center here in Urbana-Champaign, since it was certainly the experiences of people like Peter Miller, who were in Seattle in 1999 and who came back here to Champaign-Urbana, mm-hmm. that helped to put it together. And then there was folks like me who were more spectators here in Champaign-Urbana and talked to Peter and seen what went on. And I thought, and many other people here thought, I don't see why we can't do that here, you know, because if you looked at the sort of the practicalities, it was a matter they acquired some space, they got some networking in there, some computers and some media equipment so that people could go and have the opportunity to go out and collect media and bring it back. Very much like community radio, except multimedia. And because it's not radio, not bound by the terms of a Federal Communications Commission license, which, you know, it is kind of a big thing both legally and economically. Station is expensive to run on its own. Without that burden, you know, you're perhaps a little bit more flexible and a little bit more free. And the seeds for the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center came together in September of 2000. Danielle Shenowith, who is on the Urbana City Council now, invited people to her home. And that was actually, you know, the place where the Independent Media Center of Urbana-Champaign began meeting weekly to try and plan out how we want to do it. But one of the things that I thought was really neat, and it wasn't my idea by any stretch of the imagination, was in the very first meeting, it was decided, okay, we are an independent media center, let's start reporting. We didn't have a website. didn't have a radio show, didn't have a newspaper, didn't have really anything, but thought it was still important to take that immediate initiative to start reporting and to bring these things. And we figured we'd find a way to get it on the air. In some cases, it went on to WEFT and various programs, or we'd print it up onto photocopied for people to have. And then a radio show, a fill-in radio show, was acquired on WEFT, and eventually a website went up. And then the Independent Media Center, as we know it, which is a storefront in downtown Urbana, opened up on January 20th of 2001, which coincided with the inauguration of George W. Bush. It was sort of an interesting correlation of events at that time. But it's interesting how that inspiration, because we weren't really helped along by any global indie media people. No. In fact, it was really a matter of email saying to folks who were sort of at that point building the network, "Hi, we're from Urbana-Champaign. We'd love to start an IMC." And they said, "Great. We can't offer you server space because we're full right now. But otherwise, you know, if you're, you know,
we'll put up links for your site."
Pretty much. I mean, it was sort of the early growth days when, you know, I don't think that indie media was envisioned as a network the way it turned out.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it developed, but it wasn't necessarily envisioned that way. It was envisioned as, this is the way we're going to provide coverage to the WTO, and this is a model we think that will be good. And the model was adopted for other actions, such as some actions against the IMF in Washington, D.C. in April of 2000.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And for things like the Democratic and Republican National Conventions in Los Angeles and Philadelphia of that year. And so the same techniques were put forward. But then I don't think it was predicted that individual cities and, you know, collectives in different cities around the world would say, "Hey, we could use this, you know, and we don't have a big event, but we could use this for everyday reporting."
Mm-hmm.
And it's really just shaped by the people who got involved, not by any central map. Not by any planning agency, and not by a Politburo, or not by, you know, a board of directors who somewhere in Seattle or elsewhere decide this is the direction of the network. It was really determined by the types of things that individual people and individual centers decided to get involved in. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. We'll be back in 1 week with more news and views on our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek on the web at www.mediageek.org. There you can read the Media Geek blog for news that can't fit onto the show, as well as download archive episodes of the program in MP3 in the open-source Ogg Vorbis format. If you have any comments about the program, please send them to paul@mediageek.org. I'm host and executive producer Paul Riesmandel. Our producer is Drew Tirico. Media Geek is produced live at community radio station WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Some pre-production happens at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center. Media Geek is also heard on KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, and on KQRP in Salida, California. And Media Geek is free to broadcast on your local non-commercial station, too. To inquire, please send email to paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.